This is a podcast from ABC Local Radio Overnights. I'm Rod Quinn. Time for our look at Australian history. And this morning, we're looking at the history of the waterfront in this country. Duncan McNabb is one of Australia's, well, how can we describe him? Leading authors about the crime, the criminal milieu, former police detective, journalist, and author of many books, including one fabulous one about bikies, but also this latest one is Waterfront, Graft, Corruption and Violence, Australia's Crime Frontier from 1788 to now. Duncan, thank you very much.
Good morning, Rod.
I don't want to start in 1788. I want to start now. How bad is the violence, the graft, the corruption, the crime on our waterfront?
On our waterfront these days, I think graft and corruption, sure, and crime, pretty redolent. The waterfront still remains the most effective way to get large quantities of illicit product, like ice, for example, through into the Australian market. We can get it through by the container load, which makes the waterfront cheap and accessible. And as we're seeing with some recent heists, I think down in Melbourne and Sydney, almost $1 billion worth of the stuff has come through. It's an easy, inexpensive way to get an easy, inexpensively sourced product into the country. So it's not like the old days with wharfies pinching things left, right and centre and handbags and shoes and God knows else what going missing. Today, drugs drive the criminal market in this country, and that's a sad fact, sadly.
Okay, so putting the drugs aside for one moment, what else are we talking about? Illegal imports, is that the main crime? And if that is happening, and you're talking about graft and corruption, are people being paid off?
People have to be paid off to get through. The main driver these days in the waterfront is drugs. Back in the older days, you'd be worrying about colour TV sets being pinched or anything that was basically portable, a wharfie could carry off the dock. These days, with containerisation, modern waterfront, you can bring in large quantities of high-value illicit substances, ice, amphetamines, cocaine, that sort of thing. That can come in quite readily. And sure, some people in that supply chain are paid off from the time it leaves the ship through the waterfront into the distribution channels. You know, these days it's really easy. You unload a container, whack it in the back of a truck, drive it through the gate and into a distribution place. It's easy, fast, efficient, and pretty low risk.
Okay, so if you're importing ice from China,
yep,
which nearly all of it comes from, or you're saying from the Golden Triangle area, is that where it's
made?
Yeah,
the old Golden Triangle in Southeast Asia was the warlords, when heroin became a lesser business for them because Afghanistan took over, they scratched their heads and thought, this new amphetamine stuff looks good.
All right. So they're making ice and they're putting it in. What was caught? They were caught the other day putting it inside all sorts.
Also in liquid form. They liquefied it.
Right.
So they bring it in and then it comes to Australia. Then they burn the liquid off or boil the liquid off and the powder that's left is the gear they want.
Okay. So it's all packed up in containers, shipped over here, all done as if you're importing something else, statues or something like that. Who is organising it then?
In Australia, the main distribution networks tend to be some of the organised crime gangs, the Southeast Asian crime gangs, the so-called Middle Eastern crime gangs. That's how they're split up. And my old favourites, the outlaw motorcycle gangs, have been in the meth business since the 60s.
All right. So then it's taken off the wharves. There's so much stuff comes in, though. You can't look at all of it. How do the authorities know what to look for?
A couple of indicators normally with the authorities. Either they've got a tip-off from overseas, or a tip-off locally for that matter, that a certain container is coming through. They can then tag the container, watch it and its progress around the world. And when it slides through the docks, they can then pick up where the truck is loaded onto and then take it to the distribution point where they can hopefully lock up the people involved in the network and then track the network back. Sometimes some containers are tagged on the waterfront. Sometimes they'll actually just at random search a container and find what they're looking for. Okay. But the key to any good police work really is getting the intelligence that points the finger at something.
So when did this sort of opportunistic theft of, you know, colour TVs, bags, shoes, things that you can carry away, when did that kind of Well, I'm sure it hasn't ended. I'm sure it probably still goes on. Mm. But when did that form into something far more organised? Or was it always organised?
It was always, it started off with a very small organisation around about the time Arthur Phillip turned up. The organisation really hit its straps around about World War II. And in the lead up to World War II, an oddity I found when researching the book was that in the late 30s, Australia had the highest per capita cocaine use in the world, which astounded me.
Wow. Where was it coming from?
South America.
Okay. Same as today, I suppose.
Yeah, then Hitler and the Japanese put a kibosh that trade very neatly. But the waterfront also developed at that time. Huge amounts of armaments, products came through. And the waterfront communities were obviously the point where this was collated and then moved into a distribution chain, you know. And in those days, it was things like silk stockings were big during World War II. Booze, cigarettes, anything you could actually sell at a reasonable price, it was in demand in the rather strapped Australian market in those days. So that'd be taken off. If you could carry it off, you would. You'd then take it home or to your little local community. The pub was a perfect place to get rid of it. No one asked any questions. And the joy for a criminal aspect is, and it's the same with most crime organisations, a small, close-knit, trusting community. Now, in the Wharfies, of course, it was a little bit different because a lot of them, way back when, were just stealing to support their kids, make a quid every now and then and feed them.
So, I mean, Wharfies are incredibly hard workers. It's very hard work. Loading and unloading in those days, a bit different now, of course, with the way that containerisation and mechanisation is. But are you saying that, you know, for a period of more than 200 years, everybody on the wharf was on the take or doing the wrong thing?
Not everyone was doing the wrong thing or on the take, but it was an accepted part of the life. Some people would be actively involved in stealing, others would know about it but turn a blind eye to it, some would benefit from it. And it's really, back in those days, it was a supplementary income. It was just a way to make a quid to feed your family or put a roof over your head. It was a brutal lifestyle up until the 1920s and 30s. Living in a waterfront community wasn't fun.
So was this everywhere in Australia? Sydney, there's docks in Hobart, there's docks in Frio, there's docks in Melbourne, Brisbane, I'm not sure about Adelaide. I suppose they would have it as well. So was it everywhere in all the capital cities and non-capitals? I mean, Newcastle, obviously, places like that. Was it all the same? Was it all corrupt violent?
Not so much it was violent. The waterfront communities tend to look after themselves, really close-knit. Violence tended to be more of a domestic violence nature than anything else. And they took their... If there was violence involved, it would be out of the community. I suppose I remember when I was a young cop, we used to make jokes about Balmain, for example. And in Balmain, nothing would ever happen, but it was a commuter suburb for crooks. So the crooks would leave Balmain, do their bidding elsewhere in the city, then wander back to sell their product. Standard joke on the North Shore was that they'd leave places like Balmain in the morning, drive across to Chatswood or Tarramurra, do a day's burglary, and then come back.
Delightful.
Mike, how things worked.
Okay. Mike has texted in and says, an ex-wharf worker told me he would get picked out of a mob of blokes because he knew the foreman looking for work on the wharves. He would then get cabin keys off a sailor coming off a ship and sleep all day in his bunk. Is that a familiar kind of story?
Absolutely.
You know, there have been, and we'll get to the attempts to clean up the wharves, yep, which happened in the 90s, really, or late 90s. But prior to that, was there a lot of feather bedding going on? Because that's what we often hear about, is that people turned up and did nothing.
It was a very comfortable organisation and became more comfortable when mechanisation hit the wharves, again, courtesy of small things like steam-powered lifting equipment. And in the 40s and early 50s, when containers came in, all of a sudden you've got this big workforce that doesn't have to work as hard as it used to. So there's
I wouldn't begrudge them that, by the way.
No, a brutal bloody lifestyle. Yeah. The injuries these poor guys suffered in the old days were horrific, and no one really cared that much.
Things dropping on them.
Dropping on them and carrying bags of a couple hundred pounds on their shoulders repeatedly in and often on the wharves. Back in World War II is a perfect example. It became a protected employment, so you wouldn't get called up if you were a wharfie. And it was amazing the number of well-to-do families that would have their sons looming to that conscription, or looming towards that age where they'd be drafted into service, suddenly take an interest in doing manual labour on the waterfront. So, you know, you totter down from Bellevue Hill or Double Bay in the morning, loiter around the wharf, don't do too much, and then go home at night. But the families would pay some of the waterfront organisers to make sure that your son was part of the union.
Waterside Workers Federation, one of the most notorious unions, you might say, because they could stop when, in the old days, when everything came by ship. If they went on strike, nothing moved. How powerful were they?
Incredibly powerful. Great, I suppose, interesting history of the Waterside Workers Union too. Billy Hughes was one of their first proponents. Hughes used the waterside workers when he organised, he got them together really and organised them and made them into a cohesive body, and realised that they had political clout came from that, and that launched his career as into Labour politics at the very beginning of the ALP, and got him into the top job as Prime Minister, which he held briefly before he had multiple party changes. So the waterside workers had enormous power. They could bring the country to a halt. And particularly up until the 50s and early 60s, when our exports really drove the nation. Exports like wool, for example. Wool was one of our huge money spinners from the 1850s onwards.
We rode to prosperity on the sheep's back,
and followed that with coal. And all of a sudden, if the waterside workers say, not loading your boat, mate, you've got some strife.
Okay, so I was mostly thinking about imports, but exports, obviously their work is just as important and they could control that. Were they skimming stuff off the top there as well, or what would they do with coal or wool?
No, they weren't all that interested in coal or wool. I think, from what I've seen, coal and wool provided with them with the economic clout in politics that they needed to say, well, we want X and we're going to slow things down if we don't get it. The criminal side of things, the pilfering, I suppose, was very much imports. We weren't much of a manufacturing nation back then, so everything coming through the waterfront, golden opportunity. I think, as I mentioned, colour TV sets were huge TV sets when they first came in. And I remember a great story about a wharfie who was a little under the weather one night and fancied an Aston Martin, which had just arrived.
He
decided to hoist it over the fence, which wasn't all that clever, with a forklift. Now, that's not the smartest thing to do, but he drove the forklift through the car instead. Yeah, expensive business.
Okay, all the cars now, really, will be coming via the wharves. With the decline, the end of car manufacturing in Australia. What about stories of, you talk about the Aston Martin, did cars go missing?
Yeah, I think anything that could be driven, anything that could be removed comfortably from the wharf, and law enforcement on the wharf, by the way, for years, and not so much recently, but back in the old days, law enforcement on the wharf was hard. If the coppers or the security blokes would turn up and start asking questions, the wharfies would start talking about going on strike. So suddenly, the cash economy met the formal economy, and the cash economy tended to win.
Okay, but lest we think that it was all the wharfies making these, doing these things, the bosses were pretty tough as well. How tough were they? And how much brutality might have been meted out to the wharfies?
I think wharfies back in the old days, particularly up until the World War II, had a rough time. Their working conditions were deplorable. They worked in all manner of weather. They carved the most ghastly things out of boats, a hold full of bags of concrete, which they're breathing in all day, that sort of stuff. The organiser on the wharf would also control who worked that day. So you'd have 10 blokes turn up, and as you mentioned earlier, the favourites would, as a gentleman who texted you, the favourites would then be picked. And they were the blokes who would get work that day. And if you didn't get picked or you weren't a favourite, you went home.
This is an appalling situation, really, for the poor wharfies, that unless you got that work, you didn't eat.
That's exactly it. Now, 7-day-a-week job. If you got 2 or 3 days a week, and one old wharfie's family I spoke to, they were delighted if the husband would get 2 or 3 days, because it meant they could eat and meant they could turn a light switch on.
So, and Duncan McNabb is our guest, and we're talking about the waterfront in Australia, waterfront, graft, corruption and violence, 1788 to now. How organised was it, though, on the wharves? And I'm talking about the bosses, the company owners, they must have known what was going on. What kind of blind eye did they turn to this sort of thing? Or did they attempt to do something about it?
A bit of both. Largely, they put it down as a cost of doing business. They knew it was going to happen, but they didn't want the waterfront to stop. Their own companies and the politics overlaying it all. So they tended to turn a blind eye to it. There were a couple of attempts. I mean, it was one of the cute things about history. You read back in the 1920s, a Queensland Royal Commissioner thundering about crime is rife on the waterfront. And you read the same thing 100 years later. Mm-hmm. We didn't do much about it. That was the problem. I think we should have possibly not been more aggressive, but we should have policed things more effectively back in the old days before that mindset became acceptable. There were a couple of attempts to clean the waterfront up, but they're all half-hearted. Back in the 1920s in Melbourne, they did some constructive things. They got coppers on side. They sort of brought the unions and the employers together, which was great. In Sydney, they looked at it and thought, those security blokes are a bit expensive. We won't worry about that till it becomes a real problem. It's a very city attitude to things.
Wow. Now, Wayne from Oakley says Melbourne's famed Painters and Dockers Union had some interesting characters. Putty Nose Nichols was one. Billy the Texan was another one, I think. Tell me about the Painters and Dockers, who became notorious in the 80s because of that Royal Commission that then went off in a completely different direction.
Yeah, the Painters and Dockers were, again, they actually had probably the worst jobs on the docks back in the older days of early sail and steam. These are the blokes who had to get down in the bilges and scrub things. I mean, carrying bags off is bad enough, but having to get down in those places, forget it. The most miserable job on the waterfront. But when things modernised and after World War II, we started bringing in faster ships, more modern container handling, all that sort of stuff, the painters and dockers sort of became redundant almost. So they went into crime quite effectively, which they'd been dabbling in for years. And there's lovely stories of, almost lovely stories, of the painters and dockers actually recruiting in Pentridge. So when you got out of jail, you'd be guaranteed a job. That's fine because there was a bit of work around, but a lot of the painters and dockers sort of signed on and then went off and did armed robberies and all that sort of stuff and signed off, had a beer with their mates and went home. And you got
a perfect alibi. I was working all day and these 10 people will say that I was here.
Exactly. And it was spawned some characters like Putty Nose Nichols, Bill Longley, who's just departed from about a year or two ago, and men like that wonderful Christopher Dale Flannery, one of our most notorious criminals in both Sydney and Melbourne. Yeah, he was a painter and docker. Our whole families, a lot of the Melbourne mob we saw about an underbelly years ago, they were nominally painters and dockers. There's a fascinating bloke called Graham Kinnebra, known as the Munster, who was a Melbourne crim, very prominent, and he was a painter and docker and got killed in the ganglands. Now, he lived in the suburb of Kew, where some of Australia's notables live, this lovely big pile. So, you know, working as a humble painter and docker had its profits.
Duncan McNabb is our guest. We're talking about the waterfront, the history of the waterfront in Australia, and sadly, the graft, corruption and violence of it. And if there's something you'd like to discuss, if there's a question you'd like to ask Duncan, or maybe you'd like to tell us a story, please no names, or if you worked on the wharves, or maybe your family members worked on the wharves, we'd love to hear from you. What were the wharves like? I spent some time, I was employed in a government department and had a lot to do with wharfies for a long time there, and they were really lovely blokes. And look, I don't know what they did in their spare time, but they were really salt of the earth characters. I really enjoyed spending time with them.
I grew up among them. Our family's an old waterfront family, and the wharfies were always, you know, good, hard working, decent people. One of the quirks in crime I've noticed in writing about it for so long is that a lot of so called criminal families have a very strong moral background. They have very strong views. They're incredibly helpful, decent people. They just earn their money slightly to the left of centre. But they're strong, they're principled, and they're utterly honourable. They just happen to be crooks.
We can't talk about this without talking about the waterfront dispute of the 1990s when maybe, look, depending on what side that you're on, somebody tried to do something about this. Now, what was tried, you know, what was the attempt, and was it, did they just go about it the wrong way, or what's your feeling about what happened with the waterfront dispute?
It was a bit like Dad's army trying to defend the coast. It wasn't, the upshot, the plan that they had was to actually finally get the, bring the unions to the negotiating table and point out that things had shifted. The modern waterfront, you're a bit of an anachronism, so start behaving yourself. That's a very broad view. The method by which they chose to do it was a little bit sneaky. And I, just as a curiosity, I was working in television then, and I was one of the first journalists down on the waterfront when it happened. I was working at Channel 9 at the time. And I knew a lot of the characters from a previous life. You had setting up the waterfront takeover force, the Dad's Army Group, were a group of Australian ex-military blokes, including one fairly senior member of Australia's security services back in the old days, this murky gentleman who used to walk around in a safari suit, and I'll leave it there.
Safari suit? Wow.
Oh, yeah, he's always wearing a safari suit, even into the 90s, which was quite impressive. So they set up this military force. They trained them, I think, in the United Arab Emirates, from memory, and decided they were going to sneak them into Melbourne one night and take over. The big mistake they made, and like all military plans, you know, the first time you step forward, it all goes to hell. Some genius decided that they needed to hire some cranes. So they rang a company that hired large cranes and said, you know, can you deliver us a couple down to Swanson Docks or wherever it was? What they hadn't remembered is that the guy they were ringing was probably going to be a unionist. So this guy gets the order and thinks, uh-oh, something's happening here.
Why did he think that something was up?
Because there'd been reports of it leading up. There's this sort of military force being put together and trained. And the first gunshot was when some genius decided to actually ring the crane hire company. And the bloke picking up the phone, I think, was either a wharfie or a painter and docker. A former painter and docker. They'd gone by then. So he pushed the button, and all of a sudden we have this dreadful fracas on Melbourne wharves that then moved to Sydney wharves. It did actually change the face of the waterfront here. The union sort of came out of the battle a lot less significant than it was. I think it restructured the waterfront. It got rid of the old guard left, and the new guard, who were more negotiable, more politically astute, came in.
This is the MUA, the Maritime Union Australia, MUA here to stay. Remember that at the time. So in what way were they different to the old Waterside Workers Federation or the Painters and Dockers?
These days, they're nowhere near as militant. They negotiate. I think they have a better understanding of where they sit in the scheme of things. The old MUA was a lot of the old dogs having their last bark, unfortunately. And they didn't quite understand that Australia's waterfront needed to modernise. I think at the time of the takeover, or the attempted takeover, we had appallingly slow container rates. Things were just, you know, our docks were really almost sedentary at some stage. So, and the owners, I don't think unreasonably, said, you know, we need to come up to world standards in these things.
Duncan McNabb is our guest. There's something you'd like to know about the waterfront, or something that you'd like to ask, some stories you'd like to tell. Maybe it's the fact that there aren't a lot of people who work on the docks these days. I'm sure it used to be incredibly well populated. And do you know how many people work on the wharves these days?
Not sure how many we have these days, but you're quite right. The need for workers on the waterfront dropped dramatically, and it's been plummeting for years. It's also stopped being the sort of the job that you would have to almost be a family member to get, a bit like trying to be a member of the SCG or the MCG. You've got to have your name put down at birth. The maritime unions were not dissimilar, so they recruited out of that very small pan, and you actually had to be accepted into that community. These days, it's quite diverse. But at the same time, we're also seeing different families working on the wharves, bringing in their families as well.
What do they do? What work is done on the wharves these days?
Crane driving, unloading, quite often the container, bringing the containers onto the backs of trucks, the tally work, you know, this container comes from XYZ, all that sort of thing. Containers are all sort of quite, the business is actually quite well controlled, so you can actually trace a container. That's the sort of business they do. It's really clean. It's reasonably efficient. You know, crane drivers, safety people watching the cranes. That sort of stuff.
Okay. What about the fact that in you know, Sydney, for example, much of the work has gone from the docks of Sydney Harbour, and it's done elsewhere at Botany Bay and places like that, or Port Botany.
Yep.
You know, how's that changed the face of the business?
A couple of things. In the older days, too, a lot of things arrived by ship. It had been taken into a big waterfront bond store or a warehouse where it would sit.
You still see them down by the wharves.
Yeah, that those days are gone. It comes in, it's on the back of a truck and out the gates of the wharf in a really rapid time. So that's changed dramatically, and the suburbs have changed. You'd be hard pressed to find a wharfie in Balmain or around Fitzroy these days.
A shame.
And those old, hard-working buildings, the old bond stores, they're now renovated restaurants. Nice housing. And Port Botany is just basically a six-lane highway in and out as fast as possible.
Duncan McNabb, our guest, who will take some calls in just a moment. You're with Rod Quinn on ABC Local Radio. This is the Overnights program. And our Australian history feature this morning is about the history of the Australian waterfront. Duncan McNabb is our guest, author of Waterfront. And Tracy would like to talk to you. Good morning, Tracy.
Oh, good morning.
Yes, what would you like to know?
Mr. McNabb, you mentioned Christopher Dale Flannery.
Yep.
Was a painter and docker in Melbourne.
Yes, he was.
Yeah. Is that where he formed his identity as Mr. Rentokil?
He did, actually. He came from, a nice family, just decent, hard-working people, brought up by his mother and his elder sister and his older brother. Father disappeared fairly early on. He wandered into crime. He was involved in crime from his teens onwards, and his first alleged killings were in Melbourne. He was quite prolific, actually.
How prolific?
He always bragged about doing somewhere between 9 and 12, depending on his mood, killings. He first came to prominence when he murdered a solicitor, allegedly.
He hasn't been seen. I don't think he's going to come forward now and say, hang on, I resent that, I'm taking you to court.
I did hear he was actually having a drink in Rio with Lord Lucan.
Is that right? Yeah.
And curious, as an oddity, when he came to Sydney, because Melbourne was getting a bit hot for him, he tried to join the waterfront unions up here. And a bloke I spoke to said, you know, he came in, he said, you know, I'm a painter and docker, I'd like a job up here, you know, wink, wink. And the Sydney waterside workers just said, mate, you're too crazy, no way known. Wise choice, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tracy, is there a reason you wanted to know about Christopher Dale Flannery?
Just something personal.
Something personal.
Okay. Oh, well, yes.
No, we don't need to go any further than that. So, Tracy, thank you very much. 1-300-700-222 is the number, 1-300-700-222. We're talking about the violence on the waterfront. What type of violence are we talking about here?
The waterfront, the actual workers in the waterfront, they weren't particularly violent toward each other. You know, pub brawls, that sort of stuff. Demarcation disputes on the waterfront periodically, that sort of thing. The violence that sort of moved out of the waterfront was blokes who then took up violence for hire. So, you know, like the painters and dockers, for example, violence for hire became something they made good money out of. Anything from a contract killing like Christopher Flannery backwards to sorting out debt problems, sorting out problems with competition. Some of the most fearsome men in Australian crime were waterfront enforcers. In Sydney, there's a bloke called Stan Smith, or Stan the Man Smith. And Stan was a saxophone player by choice. And he always wanted to be a professional musician, couldn't quite do it. Remarkable with his fist, and the man with absolutely without fear. If Stan walked in and said, you're going to do X or you owe X, you'd say, yeah, fine. How soon can I pay up?
Oh, dear.
Stan was an extraordinary character, but in his spare time, liked to play the saxophone and eventually became a Baptist lay preacher. Just one of those wonderful, diverse characters.
Wonderful character, unless you across him.
Yeah, as a friend, wonderful, I'm told. As an enemy, then good luck.
Who else? I mean, Flannery and Stan the Man Smith. Who are the other perhaps not so notorious, but famous wharfies. I remember, and I don't know if it's in your book, but Fred Jones, he was the man who captained Manly to their first premiership in 1972. He was a wharfie. I mean, these were the days when footballers actually had proper jobs, and he had worked on the wharves.
I'm having a flashback to my childhood on the northern beaches. There I hadn't thought of Freddie in a lot of years.
Still with us. Yeah. Great player, Freddie Jones. Played for Australia.
It was curious. The waterfront would have blokes like Fred. The Coppers were exactly the same at the same time. You had lots of rugby league players in it. Most of the wharfies I looked at led fairly quiet lives. You only heard about the really colourful ones, the Lenny McPherson's, for example, another one.
He was a wharfie?
Lenny started out as
the Mr. Big of Sydney Crime.
Yeah, he started out as a wharfie ostensibly working at Mort's Dock in Balmain, so he could actually get out of having to go and serve in World War II as his main motivator. Progressed quite nicely at Mort's Dock, and in the late 40s, I think it was, arranged a major armed robbery out there where Darcy Dugan, possibly the most incompetent criminal in Australian history. Every time Darcy did something, he got arrested. Turned up with a machine gun and sprayed the pavement in Balmain with a machine gun, tried to make off with the payroll, didn't succeed. Lenny was waiting for him to also help him get away. Lenny put him up in Collaroy, actually, for a couple of weeks while the heat came off the armed robbery, and then gave him up to the coppers. Lenny was wonderful. Lenny was one of these blokes who would arrange crimes and then dob you into the coppers if he thought it was to his advantage. But Lenny came from an old waterfront family.
Ken says, regarding the waterfront dispute, no doubt that Australia's waterfront needed to reform, but the way to do it was not setting up a $2 shelf company called FinWest and recruit former and current Australian Defence Force and controversial private security firms. So, you know, there is a way of doing it, and that was not the way.
He's right. That was certainly not the way to do it. Handled very, very poorly.
We'll talk to Gary now. Gary is a former wharfie. G'day, Gary.
No, I'm a wool classer.
A wool classer, okay, yeah.
And I used to work at Miller's Point in the wool stores there.
Beautiful place, yep.
And to get to the wool store, this was sometime in the 50s, I think, I'd have to go past what they call the Hungry Mile.
Yes.
It was the wharfies lined up waiting for a job, and they were all in caps and whatever, you know, the dress that they wore then.
Yep.
And there was a Hungry Mile. You'd have to walk past all these fellas waiting to get a job on a wharf.
This was down at Hickson Road.
Well, I don't know what the name of the road was, but it was Miller's Point. I worked in the wool stores there.
Gary, thank you very much. Now, one of the great things about that is if you live in Sydney or you visit Sydney, you can still go there. And even though it has been zooshed up a lot, you can still see those old wool stores, bond stores, many of them still in existence. And the Hungry Mile or Hickson Road is the main road past where Barangaroo, the development is going on at the moment. So that's a classic example of what used to be the docks and now it's, you know, the international casinos.
Out of change. Both my grandfathers actually spent the Depression down there. One was a bank manager, one was a sea captain. I know, strange. And standing in those very same queues, hoping to get picked to do a day's work, neither of them actually had a clue how they'd do it, but they just had a set of hands and hope they could make a quid. And a lot of Australians from this broad spectrum spent days on the Hungry Mile during the Depression just hoping to get a menial job.
Was there any difference between the docks of the various cities, the Frio docks, because Fremantle was way on the other side of the country to where a lot of the stuff was happening? You know, was that a bit wilder? The fact that, you know, there was a bit of distance between Western Australia and, you know, the eastern states.
Interesting point, actually, yeah. There was quite a lot of industrial disputes in Frio docks, and there are riots and all sorts of things happening across there back in the 20s and 30s. They were feistier, I think you'd say. Sydney and Melbourne tended to be a lot calmer, and I suppose from my particular bent on crime, criminals don't like to paint targets on their backs. Mm-hmm. So you don't want a lot of disruption. You want to control your disruptions. Yeah, Frio was pretty wild. I think one guy actually died in a protest. They were quite militant as well.
Right.
And they take on authority if they needed to.
So when you say that, and I understand why, the criminals, they don't want anyone coming in and looking around at what they're doing, so they don't want to have strikes and industrial action and that. Why was there so much? Were they able to control it?
They were able to control it. I think a lot of the strikes, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne, you know, that main choke point for the nation, were to actually say we have political clout and we're prepared to use it. It was a bargaining chip. And in the 50s, particularly, at once Menzies pulled them on when he was pulling on the Communist Party and everybody else, and lost comprehensively. And that gave the waterfront unions more power than they'd ever had before. Not power in a statute, but they knew that they had a bargaining chip and Menzies had balked so they could give him a good hard push. And that was around for a lot of years. And I think that's one of the reasons why it took so long for the waterfront to sort of reshape itself. And that the Finn West routine back in the late 90s is probably the first serious attempt to reform it.
Any politicians come out of the unions?
Billy Hughes.
Yeah.
Stacks of the early Labor Party leaders were all wharfies. I think Andrew Fisher was a wharfie at one stage. That certainly that tranche of ALP politicians up until the end of World War One came out of the unions. Many of them came out of the waterfront unions. So you had Prime Minister and Cabinet substantially represented. So yeah, it bought them a huge amount of clout as well.
Okay. What is the situation like these days? You say it's very clinical almost, that you've got to... The feather bedding to a greater or lesser degree has gone. Mm. That, you know, it's a professional business these days. Is most of the crime on the importing side, or is there other stuff going on there that has never gone away?
I think most of the crime is on the importing stuff. And it's driven by the huge Australian market. We whack more up our nose than anywhere else in the world still. I don't know whether that's something to be proud about.
I don't think so.
Nah. But that huge amount of money from drugs drives the business. I don't think there's much feather bedding on the wharves these days. It's a matter of getting product off the boat, whether it be licit or illicit, onto a truck and out into the marketplace as fast as possible. There's no dawdling on the wharves these days.
So that was one of the things you mentioned earlier, which was about the work rate, the clearance rate. What was it?
I think they called it a crane rate or something.
Crane rate. Yeah. Okay. So how many container loads were moved per hour or something? And we had a terrible rate. Why was that? It was because the longer it took, the more work you got, the more you got paid.
Yeah, the waterfront unions decided, why would we move quickly? There's no benefit in it for us. The longer we take, the overtime we get, the more people needed to shift them. It was sort of, it was a very slow moving hot afternoon waterfront, and the rest of the world had sped up enormously. So you had crane rates significantly higher. I'm not sure what they are, but significantly higher. So the rest of the world's waterfronts were spinning. Australian waterfronts were dawdling, and that just wasn't working.
Okay. Mike wants to know about the tow cutter gang. Were they involved with the wharfies?
On the periphery. Okay. I think some of the boys in the tow cutter gangs may have been involved in the waterfront, but they were basically inner city toughs, violent criminals, a bit like the razor gangs in Sydney. Mm-hmm. They'd cruise the streets searching for opportunities. Cocaine or ripping off cocaine just runners, for example, in the 20s and 30s. That's where these gangs got their money.
Sounds like cocaine's been a problem on the waterfront for nearly 100 years or so.
Yeah, it has. In Sydney, it was run by two ladies, the lovely Tilly Devine and Kate Lee. Yeah. They'd bring it on, they'd come in off the ships from South America, disappear into the waterfront community, then get distributed through the brothels of Sydney. Very popular after World War One with returning servicemen who used it to for pain relief.
They'd snort it the way that people would do that
now? Snort it, inject it. It was a very common product.
Why isn't that more well known? I mean, I was not aware of that. I mean, we hear about cocaine in the 80s in Australia really taking off. But here you are saying that it was the case 60 years earlier.
Yeah, it surprised me. It surprised me that we used so much of it back in those days. It was legal for a lot of years.
Yeah.
But then again, back in those days too, heroin was also legal and a very commonly prescribed drug. We got neatly hooked very early on. but cocaine particularly back in the 20s and 30s in Sydney and Melbourne was a huge criminal driver. It had come in. Squizzy Taylor in Melbourne was also a big coke supplier. And it hit every echelon. Interesting thing about cocaine is it's like ice. It was popular with working people all the way through to the top end of society. It's one of those drugs that really had no social inhibitors.
What about one of the most colourful aspects of the waterfront? That is the pubs. What can you tell us about some of the famous pubs, whether they be in Balmain or in you know, Frio or in Melbourne or Brisbane or whatever? Are there any that stand out?
It, for me, as a very young detective, one stands out. It was the Big House down at, which I think is still there, the building is anyway, in Sydney. And I remember we went in there one morning to make some investigations, which involved standing at the bar having a drink at 7 a.m.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, no, welcome to the old days. And I wandered out, as one does after a couple of schooners of beer, and found that this couple of young ladies were plying their trade in the men's lavatory, and I had a chat to them. And they did remarkably good business with blokes coming off shift. You know, that's a...
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a story. Perhaps move on.
That's still there. I mean, I don't think that still goes on.
I don't think that still goes on.
But I worked. I used to work practically next door to the Big House, and it went through a few different names. Napoleon's, because it was on Napoleon Street as well.
That's right, yeah.
And at one point, Arthur Beetson, the legendary Australian rugby league player, he ran it. I don't think he owned it, but he ran it, Big Artie's Big House. They had the House of the Dragon, one of the great Chinese restaurants, too, was there.
That's right, yeah.
And they used to have strippers on at lunchtime, and I'm going to be honest and say I went with the blokes from the office once, and once was more than enough. It was an experience that I do not wish to repeat. It was a bizarre in the middle of the day to see all these blokes coming around. It was amazing. It was an extraordinary moment.
A glimpse of old Sydney. But pubs like that, I suppose they also dealt with the people who worked different shifts. I mean, the waterfront at one stage were working, you know, late nights through to early mornings. And that's why we have early openers back in those days.
You indeed
come off shift for a beer at 4 o'clock.
In the morning.
Yeah.
But not anymore, not with the lockout laws.
No, that bit of Sydney's long since departed. But the pubs were where the blokes would get together. It's where they'd, you know, if you wanted to become a wharfie, you'd probably chat to people at a pub to get into the swing. Yeah. It's where a lot of product that was pilfered from the wharf would be negotiated. It's where settlements were done.
If you wanted a TV, you'd go to a pub near
that
wharf.
Absolutely, like my father did.
Yeah. Okay, Doug is with us. Doug, good morning.
Good morning, Rod. How are you going?
Going well. You used to work on the wharves, did you?
No. I worked in NSF Melbourne at a company, and every day of the week we'd have some guys come in, and they're probably West Indian, with suitcases. And they'd walk in with these suitcases, open the suitcase, and if you wanted to buy something, they had it for sale.
Anything?
Anything, and I mean anything. Like, I remember, it's a funny thing, Seiko watches used to be pretty popular back in the 60s and 70s. Well, you'd pick up the watch, and it'd be S-E-A-K-O. So you think, you know, and these guys, they'd come in, they're really nice guys, you know, black as, and the big smile. Yeah, they were having a ball, but they made some money.
Did you ever buy anything, Doug?
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah.
Like what?
Oh, I bought a watch. You know,
how long did it work for, though?
A couple of weeks. You know, you buy cigarettes. You buy Marlboro cigarettes. Another funny thing with the wharf, I can remember back in the 60s and 70s down in Melbourne, they went on strike for a couple of weeks because of the dim sims.
What, they weren't good enough?
They changed the brand of dim sim for some, I don't know.
That is a hanging offence, yeah.
Well, yeah, well, it was for the wharfies, and they actually closed the wharfs down for about 2 weeks.
Because of the dim sims.
Because of the dim sims, yep.
Gotta love it, Doug. Thanks, mate.
Thanks, Rod.
Duncan, does that ring true? I mean, I'm sure it's true, but the thing is, that's the sort of thing that would close down the wharves?
It was unfortunate. It's what started taking their credibility out and giving it a hiding. They'd go on strike for some of the most puerile things just to prove. And it's about the politics of power. It's saying, we don't like your dim sims. We don't like the dim sims you're giving us. We're going on strike because we can. And that's why the waterfront slowed down, and that's why the union started to get a bit distant from the marketplace. And it's back in that time where I think when we're all growing up, you think Christmas time there'll be a beer strike.
A mail strike.
Easter time the petrol would Yeah. And you think, okay. And the Wharfies are always having their own little random strikes just to make the point that they could. Okay. It wasn't smart.
Ken says, regarding the wool classer who rang about the Hungry Mile, arguably in 2016 the Hungry Mile still exists, yet you no longer get up at 4 a.m. You just stay home and wait for a text message. Is that right? Is there still day labouring work on the wharves? How does it work these days?
No. One of the great industrial shifts back about 50-odd years ago was to remove people from day labouring, get them into a job, make sure that they had appropriate insurances, benefits, health, long service leave, all that sort of stuff. That day labouring went by the wayside a long time ago.
Okay.
It's become, you know, a permanent job.
Is it a well-paid job, or was it a well-paid job back in those days? You know, was it because it was hard work? I know the thing is, obviously, a lot of people wanted to do it. There are always people lining up to get that work. Was it well-paid?
Certainly. By the time the 60s came around and the waterfront community started to break up because of affluence, you know, we thought, why would we want to live in this grotty little workers' cottage when we can get a quarter acre with a tree?
Even though now those houses be worth a fortune.
Yeah. I think they're probably cursing themselves for that.
Yeah.
The money was remarkable, with penalty rate, shift allowance, all this sort of stuff rolled in. The Wharfies were making great money. I think I remember when I was researching the book, one of the 70s, 80s, one of the waterfront people I spoke to was making probably as much money as a prime minister.
Wow.
You're talking six-figure incomes for a manual, essentially sort of a contemporary version of manual labour.
But they earned that money.
Oh, yes. Yes, they earned it. Certainly.
They worked hard.
What about
the bosses? Were they making a lot of money as well?
I think the shipping companies have always made good money.
Right.
You know, it's been an incredibly lucrative business for them, which is one reason why they let the wharfies push them around for so long. They would kowtow to the economic realities of a strike because they were making so much money anyway.
We don't have strikes anymore, is that right?
We don't have many.
I can't even remember the last. I mean, maybe you just don't hear about them anymore.
Good point, actually. I'm hard-pressed. The last major strike I remember is when the pilots strike back in the late 80s.
Okay. So I suppose the Accord helped out.
Yeah, I just don't think we operate that way anymore. We negotiate rather than stand outside banging a picket. Different way to do things.
Both sides have learnt about how to deal with it.
Yeah.
Is it a good life? Is it a good job now, do you think?
I think it'd be quite a good job. It's well paid still. It's reasonably safe. There's unless you get a container dropped on you or something, you're not going to have too much of a problem.
Was there a high attrition rate in the old days?
Back in the old days, blokes were literally dropping. And I remember terrible stories of blokes with asbestosis because they're carting asbestos out of things. Horrible back conditions because they're carrying sugar bags full of anything.
Sugar sometimes.
Yeah, periodically sugar. They used to be wheat and wool and all sorts of things. They used to get, shipping owners used to pay by the bag or something or other. So they would, people transporting stuff would actually shove as much into a bag as possible, whether that happened to be blue metal or feathers.
Yeah.
It didn't make much difference if they get it into the bag. So when the poor old wharfie threw it on his shoulder, chances are his back would go with it. It was a miserable job.
Any women?
No. Women were at home running the community, you know, looking after
they,
the kid.
I mean, they certainly not doing the manual labour, but what about in the offices?
No, very few. Very, very few. It was a really male-dominated organisation. It was that old delineation, wife at home looking after kids and family, husband working on the waterfront, couple of beers on the way home, bed on Saturday. It was a very old-fashioned life.
On Sunday?
On Sunday, I think probably a few more beers quietly at the place that wasn't open.
It's a remarkable story. Waterfront, graft, corruption and violence, Australia's crime frontier from 1788 until now. Duncan McNabb is the author and has been our guest, been very kind enough to come in on, of all days, February 29.
On
a day that you should have the day off. Duncan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rod.
Duncan McNabb. Read that book. You'll learn so much about this country. Well, that's another podcast from ABC Local Radio Overnights. I'm Rod Quinn. Thanks for listening.